I have a very general title, and it sort of reflects what I put together for this talk. So I will basically go all the way once through Drosophila from the early embryo and all the way to the pupae. And we'll show you what mostly what I'm interested in, sort of align this talk along the what I'm interested in.
And the slide background makes it the talk, right?
Yeah, so that's and so this is the outline. So I'll talk a little bit about the embryo. So very briefly, this is just some very recent experiments we did, and we're just trying to understand what we see there with some theory, which is not really fully developed. We have some idea what we want to do, but we're still in the process. So then I'll tell you about a story which we published when I was supposed to appear about 2.5, 3 years ago now, no, 2.5 years ago, about the wing formation and some mechanics in growth regulation in the Drosophila wing. And so this is in the larvae, and then we'll go to the pupae, and I'll show you a little bit what I find interesting from the physics point of view in some ordering process there. And there will be a lot of mechanics in the talk, so that's why this picture is here. And we'll talk a lot of growth regulation, so this sort of the schematic picture when we think about growth regulation due to mechanics. Okay, so let me start off with Drosophila. So this is the life cycle of the fly. So it basically, depending on temperature, this cycle can take anywhere between 12 hours to 2 weeks. And so it starts in an embryo, then there are three larva phases. That's where most of the, so the larva is just there to eat and accumulate energy in order to grow for organs, grow organs that are then sort of stitched together in the pupae, and then eventually the fly will emerge. Okay. So this is about 24 hours, then this is a couple of days here, and this is another 5 days. It all depends on temperature quite critically. So at 25 degrees, usually, that's when they usually culture that, so then it's about 2 weeks. Okay, so the early embryonic development is conveniently sectioned in 17 stages. And I'm not going to tell you all of this, I just have to sort of show you a little bit what, where the part is where I'm interested in. So this is the very early embryos, this stage 1 to 4, and sort of put them together, and there's a lot of cleavage. And I will talk about this a little later, and together with the blastoderm formation. And so I'll just skip over this very quickly, because I'm just going to go into more details in a few slides. And then there's a whole lot of tissue formation processes going on, gastrulation, that is about 2.5 to 3 hours from egg laying, and just takes 20 minutes. And then there's this germ bend elongation that basically moves the germ bend over here. And there's some interesting mechanics work done by Thomas Lecuy on this. Then there's germ bend retraction, so once it moves over here, it basically retracts again. And then a little later, then the head forms, and there's dorsal closure going on, which is also mechanically a very interesting tissue because it pulls together surrounding tissues. And then the rest is basically differentiation. So it shows you a little bit where most of the interest in the embryo is, because this 9-hour time scale is just called sort of differentiation. So not a lot of interest there, but a lot of interesting tissue movement and reorganization in this part here. But what I will concentrate on now is the early division patterns here in the early embryo. So let me show you what is sort of textbook knowledge on this early division pattern. So one thing you have to know first is that this is a syncytium, meaning that many nuclei share the same cytoplasm. So the nucleus is, so the genetic material is run by a nuclear membrane, but there's no cell wall separating different nuclei. So it's basically they all swim in the same soup. And one thing I have to say right away, I'm not going to introduce any of this patterning stuff, which is very well known for Drosophila, basically for two reasons. One is I don't need it for the rest of the talk. And the other reason is anytime you give a patterning talk in front of a physics audience, you don't get very far because there's so many questions popping up. So usually I just give a talk about patterning. I'm not gonna, won't be able to talk about anything else. But having said that, I mean, we can obviously schedule some another talk for talking about patterning genes and morphogens in the early embryo. Okay, so it's basically one big cell sharing many nuclei. And so, and it starts off obviously with one nucleus inside and then a device that is here, and that happens about 25 minutes after egg laying. And then the second stage, there are basically these divisions, cycles three to eight, and which happens all deeply in the bug. So the first nucleus is somewhere in the middle. So the dimensions here are, this is 200 micrometers, and this is around 450 micrometer long. So sort of cigar-shaped object. And initially the nuclei are here, and then the divisions sort of happen first along the main axis here, and then they arrange in a sphere, and then in cycle nine, which is the next one here, they sort of migrate to the periphery, to the membrane of the embryo, okay? And then there are a few more rounds of division, 10 to 13, and that is basically just the nuclei just getting denser here. And then finally, the blastoderm forms, and that means so all these nuclei here will basically be engulfed by membranes that just grow out, and basically each membrane will catch one nucleus. And then you have a proper epithelium with one nucleus per cell. So that's sort of the range I'm interested in, and in particular I'm interested in this early division patterns.
So the times are how long it lasts for each stage?
Yeah, so that's, yeah. And mostly I'm interested in this phase here in the next. So this is sort of textbook knowledge which was accumulated from taking a lot of DIC images on embryo state. And since we haven't really defined what the morphodynamics is, I call this morphostatic because it was basically there for 30 years and nobody really looked at it more closely. So now let's go to morphodynamics. So this is a movie of Drosophila embryo in this phase, so it's a confocal movie. So now you see the divisions inside the nucleus, and soon you will see some nuclei popping up here. So the construct we're looking at is a histone GFP marker. And you see how this division 10 to 13 are basically evolving. So there's one more on the division. And so that is the dynamic view of this early embryo. And I would like to call it the ultimate PCR machine, because what it basically does, it in 6 minutes, or in 8 minutes, it doubles the genetic material and the whole chromosomes. Okay, and then this is sort of this Gus relation and what happens later.
No, so Lars, just to understand what I'm saying here. So this is, did you call it Simsidium? Is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah.
Okay. And at this stage, there aren't any nuclei yet, but there's all a bunch of DNA.
But they are somewhere deep inside, and we're just looking at an optical section.
Okay, one optical
section. On the outside.
Okay.
And then at some point, they migrate to the surface, so you can see them. So they basically migrate into the, so somewhere.
So this is an optical section near the surface.
Yes.
Okay.
So then they basically come in. Now they migrate to the periphery.
Okay.
And you see, yeah, and then they sort of spread out.
So and none of them have membranes yet?
The nuclei have nuclear membranes,
but no
cell membrane.
Okay.
So the time scale is like 10 per division or so?
Yeah, 8. So compared to E. coli, which is 20 minutes, it's quite fast. Okay. And then you see here the nuclei get more edgy. That means the cell membrane basically just engulfed the nuclei. That's why it's. And so one thing I would like to notice, to pay attention to, are obviously the way we think about it is that Drosophila has a packaging problem. So you have all these surface divisions, and whenever a cell divides, it basically divides in some direction. and all these directions have to be coordinated, right? If they're all divided in one way, Drosophila will have a problem. And the question is if they all, if random division axis is sufficient to basically satisfy this boundary constraint of the Drosophila shell, or if there's some more order to it, and we'll show you that there's some more order to it.
Time scale here?
Time scale between frames is about 10 seconds, but between two divisions, it's 8 minutes. So from here to here, it's 8 minutes. Okay. Genetic material doubling time, so 8 minutes, or at 25 degrees. And one thing you see
is remarkably synchronized, right, the cell divisions?
Yes, but you still see this waves going through, right? So you see it usually starts on the poles, and then you see this wave. So here you can see the chromosomes align according in the mid-plane. That's where this, that's basically what happens here, and then you see how the division goes through. Okay, so then we decided to look at this a little more closely, and the first thing you have to do, you basically have to segment the images so you know where the nuclei is, so you can look at the, basically, extract some quantitative information from the image. And the way we do this is by using active contours that basically eat through the image. So you have a contour, and you can write down some dynamics for this contour, and you outline the whole image, and then this whole contour will just eat itself through the image, and whenever it finds an interesting object, and interesting, you have to tell the software what interesting means, and it will stick to it. And a good framework for this active contour is this level set implementation. So usually with the problem with, if you have contours evolving, they can split apart or they can join. And there's a very nice framework which basically just takes care of this joining and splitting of contours, and that is this level set implementation of active contours. And there, the contour is just represented by the zeros of a function. Okay. So you can think, so if this function, if the zero plane is here, and the function has some zeros, which defines a contour, and then if the function grows here, then another contour will be born here, and eventually they might fuse. So it's a very natural framework to have contour splitting and joining. And it's very powerful. It's used, for example, in lots of computer games. So this is also some implementation of flame physics in with active contours, so you can see they can break apart. And it's a very efficient way of implementing dynamics of contours. And you can do mechanics with it here. Donut mechanics. So this is just donuts falling from the sky. And then, so these have some elastic properties, then these poles have some other elastic properties. And you can naturally combine fluid and solid and elastic material and implement the robot. Because it's in a very efficient way. And I think also.
Wait, Lars, where are the contours?
So the contours are basically the outline of the donuts.
Okay.
And then you can, I mean, on this function, you can also implement mechanics. So you have curvature and all these constraints you can put in there. And that's what these people are good at, and they use it mostly for either computer games or movies. I think they actually won an Academy Award with this implementing water. So.
Those are volume elastic properties, or just surfaces?
I don't know what they exactly implemented, but you can basically rewrite most of what fits into this function, and then you can implement it in a quite efficient way. So this is how it looks in Drosophila. So we just outline the embryo, and then this contour is equated to the image, and then it basically encircles all this. So that's the, and then we also do this in 3D.
What about internal structure in the nucleus?
Well, here, yeah, so what this algorithm is doing, I just told it that it should have some curvature. So it trades off curvature against fore and background information. So that's what it compares, of course.
So, defined by zero function, but the function is still defined in the grid, so you still have just one scalar variable per per pixel or something, right? Or you're doing some sort of interpolation, lines, I don't know.
Yeah, I think what you do is,
I'm so failing to see why it's very different from flooding and algorithms.
Well, the other algorithm would be watershed, right?
Yeah, well, watershed, right, sort of watershed.
But in watershed, we have problems implementing curvature, for example, right? Smoothness of the, you could probably do that. But, so the way they represent the curve here is by the distance from, so they write, basically the distances to the curve, they write here in these boxes, which are,
so, okay,
which are.
So you're saying that they actually do interpolate. So it's not just
it's not just
the number per pixel, because that would be
that
would be flooding.
Yeah. So, but even if you have a number per pixel, you can add. So in the very general framework, you would have numbers all over the image, right?
Yeah.
Which doesn't sound like a very terrible efficient way of doing it, right? Because then you basically you simulate on the volume what you want to on the surface, right?
Right.
So then they usually. Then there are these sparse cube methods that basically just consider a certain width of values in order to be sufficient to simulate this. Because all for physics you need is basically that it's differential for each price, right? So you need just a few points to make it smooth.
Okay, fine. But they do actually deal with a smooth curve as opposed to.
So this is called sparse cube methods for IR. And then there are more, so that's sort of the what we're doing. Okay, so now once we have, once we have the nuclei.
How fast is it compared to, let's say, watershed?
I mean, it's slower than watershed, but it gives you way more flexibility in order to implement physics into your, so watershed, it's so hard to.
How long does it take to segment image like this?
Well, I would say this is just a minute or so.
Minute?
Well, that's, I'll come to another problem where it gets really severe. But there are even
movies and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there are even more efficient implementation.
Why do you actually want to implement physics?
Oh, because, for example, for some, I mean, here for the nuclei, I know that they're round, right?
Okay.
So, I mean, it's not physics.
You want
per se, it's just a prior, I want to put in, right? And maybe if this prior can be motivated by physics, even better. But I just want to basically add some prior knowledge to my.
So we both detect for those that are dividing. So do you need the same parameters to detect those that are dividing and those that are still round in your image? I mean,
yeah, so,
problem.
So then what you do is they divide, you can basically, the energy. So what you do, you write down an energy function that evolves this curve. And in this energy function, you can put an area term in there, so saying I'm looking for areas of this size. But you can also make an area term so that we'll have a minimum around this area. But you can also make an area function that has two minima. And then it basically has one minimum at one and one minimum at half the area. And then it will pick out also the dividing sum. So it gets sort of, I mean, I like it because you can interpret some of these quantities as what we're interested from a mechanical point of view. You can implement mechanics. So there might be some more steps one can do with this.
Is this done in 2D slices or?
This here is done in 2D slices, but I'll show you something on 3D. So now we're taking 3D images, which is, and then it becomes more important that this algorithm is efficient.
Did you hear anything about the missing cells on the left side here?
Here?
Yeah.
Right there? They're out of focus. Or we're not really seeing the whole embryo. So we're just looking at the single plane. So our focal depth is just, it's a confocal microscope. We'll just look at anything which is way more than, let's say, 2 or 3 micrometer, we don't see. Okay, so now we basically, for each nucleus, we have a point, and then obviously we want to track the nuclei. And then on top of it, we implement some tracking algorithm that minimizes energy between, and some again, some energy function I'm going to talk about. So then this is sort of what you get. So these are results. So what I'm plotting here is the first round of divisions, and I'm always plotting the green bars here, I hope you can see them, that's the orientation of the mother divided, or the cell divided. And then these are the two, the red and the blue curve are the two sisters that came out. And what you see here is the sort of the separation of all these nuclei. So you see it just, they separate and then they sort of continue separating over longer time. And initially they're quite fast, so that's when the spindles basically pull the genetic material apart, and then they sort of get into this more random phase. And that we basically did for all cycles, and you can see you always have this very initial fast separation due to the spindles moving genetic material, and then it sort of, at some point, will level off. And the where it levels off is basically the mean spacing between nuclei. And obviously, since we have exponential growth, this mean spacing should go down over time, right? Because we're in a constrained volume. Okay, but here you still see it goes up and then it sort of levels off. But then if you look at some later images, what you see, it just goes up and then there's not enough space. And then they're sort of squashed again together from the other nuclei. And even more here. So this is sort of the division. So the cells really, in order to separate genetic material, they have to move it's so and so far, but then there's not enough space, so all the other cells basically squeeze them back together. And you see that sort of, there's some other interesting stuff. So you see, this basically also shows you how the nuclei move after division. So here they're all, basically all were pushed out this way, and here this way, and in the middle there's not a lot of movement, and this, where there's no movement, that sort of shifts as the embryo develops. Yep.
Do you think that you need wave of divisions such that all cells are good in dividing because of the wave they have less more space to divide?
Yeah, I guess it's an interesting question. I don't have an answer for this.
Yes.
But one thing I can tell you about the wave is the wave velocity, which comes through later. So there's always this wave, and there's a lot of known about what genetically, the net genetic basis for this wave, so some cyclins which are activated.
It seems more or less important depending on the scope. So if you need, they are all synchronized, and then this division should occur.
Yeah, it looks like they are synchronized, but just wait with your questions to slides. No. Okay, so one question you can ask is sort of what Elliot showed you 2 days ago, is if you mark a cell and then you ask where the progeny went, is it just going to be sort of separate, it's going to stick together? So this will tell you a little bit about the mixing properties of the tissue. So here I just color coded them randomly. And then the next image is basically after, I don't know, probably 8 divisions, so, or 16. Okay. So this is sort of the pattern you're getting. So they always, it looks like they claim a territory and then that's basically where they are, right? So there's not a lot of mixing. Once in a while you see that they're sort of, some other cells invade this family here, but it's remarkably compact. Or, yeah.
Yeah, so do they all have like 16 cells here? Or?
I believe so, I hope so. Yeah, I didn't see the copy, yeah, there are two reds together. I think it should be. I think I checked it.
And these are automatically tracked by hand?
Yeah. So that's, so the way we do the tracking, which is probably, as you know, the harder part than segmentation. I mean, usually if you think you're 99% correct with your segmentation, it's not enough. If you track them over 100 frames, you lose each cell once, right? And then you can't do it. So here it's, so that was quite a challenge because between frames, they once in a while move more than one cell diameter. And then start to track them.
And there's again, the 2D interpenetration.
Yeah, at least on sure to show you a little bit about 3D for this sort of future work. Okay, so here's the coming back to your point, the wave velocity. So there's so the green line here is the velocity of the wave in pixels per frame. So our macrometers per second. And you see it goes, the wave is getting, it's slower and slower as you progress in more and more cycles, right?
Which wave
is
this? Is this the division wave or the density
wave front or the division?
That's the wave front of the division. So that's when the, yeah, it's a division front.
So.
Which is the same as the, when you see the chromosome is orientating in the midplane. That's also a wave going through. So that would mean that also nuclear breakdown wave is pretty much the same. And so it's, yeah. So I would expect they're all the same. I mean, I can only tell you for these two waves, division and alignment in the midplane. Nuclear breakdown I can't see. But.
I'm confused.
Okay.
You have nuclei all over, and then they divide. So I think a wave is propagating, but then I've got this thing happening all over. So how do I have the wave front?
It starts at one end and switches to the other.
So it starts always at the anterior-posterior pole, sort of close there.
Okay.
And then, and it can be linked to some mRNA.
And you're going to tell us that it's, it looks like it's synchronized from the pole.
Yeah, so at the beginning, so that's basically his question, right? So it looked like initially it was synchronized, but if you look closely at the data, what you see is if you plot the wave velocity just in micrometers per, or in frames per second, and normalize it at the beginning to one, then obviously it goes down the velocity, and that's why you can see it better and better, right? But if you also, on top of it, you plot the mean spacing between nuclei. Right, there's this cyan curve here. And then if you calculate the velocity as a function of neighbor distances, right? So think about it as a zipper, right? So if you pull, then it does, it's basically just, I mean, it's probably not the actual dimension important, but just how many elements there are, right? So, and then, so that's this red curve. So that's the velocity as a function in units of neighbor distances. And that's remarkably constant.
Could you check that if there, let's say there is variations of density within one embryo at a given time or at a given cycle? Could you check this relation, for example, that locally where it's denser, the velocity is different?
Yeah, so there was.
That would confirm this because.
There was a beautiful experiment done some years ago which one could use for this, and that's this. Cooling one side of the embryo, heating the other one, and then you get two density regimes because the division rate depends very heavily on temperature. So it can be a factor of two lower if you raise the temperature by 7 degrees. And so you get embryos which are in cycle 10 and cycle 13 at the same time. So you have two density regions. So that's sort of what we're trying to set up now as a device where we can generate the temperature gradients. So that's the physics.
So this proves that the nuclei only signal the neighbors then.
Yeah, I think that's.
And then there's a finite response.
Yeah, so that would explain this. Yeah.
So, because otherwise, the luminosity doesn't depend on the position of the embryo.
We haven't really carefully checked, but it doesn't look like.
Aren't there actually two waves? So there is a sort of cell cycle wave, but there might also be a density wave, a sound. And the question is, what's that velocity? And what can actually pull out? Because
yeah,
as you show, there is this rebound in local density.
Yeah, yeah.
So it doesn't reach the correct density yet.
Yeah, you always see the nuclei going this way, and then they
basically. And then the density wave bounces back. And the question is, what's the speed of sound in there?
I think it's So this embryo is also interesting from a different point of view, because the all the stuff surrounding the nuclei is basically actin and some other larger polymers, which have motors and are, so it's an active gel. So, okay. Damn, I'm happy I didn't talk about patterns. Okay, so here are some other measurements. So you can ask about orientation of division, right? That was the question we started out with the packaging problem. And this is the mother divides in a certain direction, and then we ask what is the direction of the daughter relative to this, to the mother, the way the mother divided. And this is, okay, everything goes from 0 to 90 degrees, and this is a accumulated distribution. So initially there's very little statistics, so I have to integrate it so it looks nice. And so what you see in, so you have a bias to perpendicular division for the first two cell cycles, right, when they're really sparse. And then in the end it goes to random. It's just dashed lines. There's no bias whatsoever. And then you can also ask daughter-daughter angle correlation. So if one daughter divides this way, is the other daughter always dividing parallel to it or perpendicular? And there you see it, early on it seems to preference perpendicular and parallel, but then it sort of goes to random.
I'm sorry, what's the y-axis?
Y is just the accumulated distribution, so it just goes from 0 to 1.
Okay.
So whenever this is steeper than 1/2, means you have more angles in this range than you would just from random, from uniform distribution.
So those curves get closer to the diagonal for later. But is that a significant effect? Because you've got more cells later as well, so you might, if it was random, you might expect that also to get closer to the diagonal.
Well, I think we have to do more averaging over embryos.
Yeah.
Right. But I think this is still a 200 cells. So here, this is 8,000 cells. But this is still, okay, 8,000. So, or 4,000. So it's still the 500 cells, just for a few. So it's not going to go. I think it's a good sample, but obviously.
But it's, but you think it's also observably different from random or hypothesis early on. There's like the variances on those curves.
Yeah, I think. I mean, we did do a statistical test on this. We could put some number on it, how significant it is. But
so
I think basically
this is basically Commodore's Smirnoff test.
Yeah, I mean, but we
just
like
look at the maximum deviation and indeed the actual significance number does depend on the number of steps.
Yeah.
But this is significant.
Yeah, I mean, this is lots of stuff. So it will be small. I mean, that's real. I mean, but still, we obviously want to know what the embryo-to-embryo variations are, and that we're doing. Okay, so then another measure is this. So you can ask if between two daughters, suppose the daughter divides in one way, so this sort of similar one I showed you, and then you just go to one nucleus, and then you ask, you can identify the neighboring nuclei by sort of Voronoi construction of the image. And then you ask if this nucleus divides in this direction, that's the red bar, so this almost normalized to be horizontal. And then you can plot wherever the neighboring nucleus is, the distance and the angle you can plot relative to this direction. And you can also plot the angle this nucleus divides, right? So this has quite a lot of information in there. So we basically rotate all, we go to all pairs, and we take one pair and rotate it, the division. So we have pairs with vector, well not vectors, but direction, just point, a headless vectors, right? And then, so we align them according to the horizontal axis, one of them, and then ask in which direction do all the other points run. And you see out here, it's just random, right? They're just all over the place. But in here, you see they're just combed along this this ellipse, right? And it's really an ellipse, so it's shorter along this way than it's along this way. It's not that I'm plotting it at a weird aspect, but it's really an ellipse, right? Because otherwise, if it were a circle, this couldn't be true, right? Because anything parallel here would basically mean, I mean, if you plot the other ratio, would also be here, because you can always put it in two ways, right? You have two points, you can align one and plot the other. And so if you have this configuration here, if you plot this down here, it would get you flat here. But it really is a circle, and they're always parallel here. So there's some order to it, and you can sort of quantify how this order decays with the distance that's sort of plotted here for different cell cycles. So this just what I'm plotting here is just the angle of the division axis relative to the normal. And you see for short distances, it's basically there's some bias to be perpendicular to the, and then it basically goes to random.
What's the cell cycles in that last color
plot? It should be from here,
right, so
going from here over here.
So the blue is the cell cycle 13.
Yeah, so this is the radar, this is the distance. Here, the radar distance.
Yeah, but
and it's just
color is a different cell cycle.
Yeah, it's a different. Yeah, this is cycle 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
And the blue one is 13.
So this is 9. Yeah.
Okay.
I hope they're all there.
So what's the
x-axis? The axis here?
Yeah.
This is just distance in pixels. Here.
So it's the distance on the x-axis and the angle on the y-axis.
Yeah, so you. Okay. So you always have this pair, right? You have one which goes here, one which goes here, and this divides this way, this divides this way. So there's a distance r,
okay,
and they keep rotating one to be horizontal. So I rotate the whole image, and then plot this line with this changed angle at this position.
So the fact that this exclusion zone is an ellipse, so that means that when the cell divides that way,
yeah,
it basically is excluding things further apart in this direction it's dividing than in the direction now.
That's right.
So does that mean it's choosing its division direction so that it's unobstructed, or?
Well, we'll see how that comes to the model. We hope could explain some of this, and we can discuss this in just a few slides.
So that's the dense vacuum later divisions of the
system
is denser.
This gets smaller and smaller, so that I sort of rescale, I guess. But so they're getting, the distance is getting smaller here.
There's it looks bigger.
Rescale it up to
the numbers are, well, that's the numbers, the limits on the numbers get smaller.
Well, you see that, yes.
See, 180.
Yeah, sorry, the numbers are really small.
Can I ask you one last question about that bottom plot?
Uh-huh.
So it's not surprising that it moves over to the left because things are getting more dense, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what is surprising to me is there's no change with cell cycle. In other words, that order parameter doesn't seem to change too much, even though you would think that higher cell cycles and denser packings would be more constrained. Is that surprising to you or not surprising to you?
Well, I was also surprised to see that there's always the same shape, right? So that's interesting.
Always the same shape.
But
I just would have naively expected that the constraint would be much stronger at the higher densities.
Yeah. Well, I think. Yeah, I'm not sure if we're picking up that with this measure. So that is, we're also not really picking up this daughter-mother correlations in this. So it's probably not.
So one thing that you notice in these sorts of things is that the structure factor, just the paracorrelation and structure factor, changes a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would have expected an order parameter like this to change a lot at the higher cell cycles too. But maybe we can talk about that later.
Yeah. At least that's concerning. Okay, so then you can also look at the pneumatic order parameters of systems, and you see as a function of distances from two randomly picked cells, and you see that for large distances it basically goes to random here, And for smaller distances, you have accumulation at, 2. So this is 2 cosine of the difference of these 2 angles. Okay, so here's the, so in a sense, this talk comes a little early. I was hoping to do it later because I wanted to develop the model a little bit here while I'm here. So anyhow, so the models together are also with Boris. So we're working on this as I'm here. So, okay, so let me, the way we think about this is, we divide this basically in 3 parts. One is nuclear division. So you're here, you have the nuclear membrane, and then you have 2 centrosomes sitting on this membrane. And the red dot here is the genetic material. You have nuclear breakdown. It's a little bit discussed if it's total nuclear breakdown or partial nuclear breakdown. And then you have the spindles forming here. So the microtubules pulling away the genetic material. And they basically originate from this asterisk here on this centrosome. Right? And then what is known is then the new centrosome, so then 2 new nuclear membranes will form, engulfing the new genetic material, the double genetic material. And then the centrosomes will basically start off on the opposite side. So there's some strong evidence for this. Okay? Good. So that's the division process. So then you have centrosome migration on the nuclear membrane. And that basically, these 2 centrosomes want to basically repel each other. And this mediated by plus and directed motors on microtubules that basically fish out the same direction of the microtubules and push them apart. So that's the migration of this, the centrosomes to opposite side. And then on top of it, you also have neighbor interactions, right? So the centrosome from this one can interact with the centrosome from this one, so by the microtubule. And then one very interesting thing about aspect of this system is that you have sort of a built-in change in your coupling constant, right? So there's a coupling constant which is basically the distance between nuclei here, right? Relative to the strength, the coupling on, or the repulsion on the nuclear membrane, right? And as the nuclei get denser and denser, it looks like the system, you can basically go from one regime to the other, right? So naively, with this picture, what you would have is it would just divide, then migrate, and you would always get basically perpendicular division relative to your mother axis. Right? So that seems to be the default state, which is also observed in many, in C. elegans and in Xenopus early on. But then as the whole thing gets, and that's also what we see in our mother-daughter correlations. And then, but as the genetic material gets denser, the mean spacing between nuclei gets smaller, then this interaction between 2 neighboring asters or centrosomes of 2 different nuclei becomes stronger relative to the on nuclear repulsion, right?
If that doesn't happen, is there some predicted variance on the daughter angle because of the exigencies of diffusion on the nuclear membrane? That sometimes one of them will diffuse a little faster than the other?
I can show you a movie of
it. Oh, okay.
So the
what about sort of spinning diffusion?
Spinning,
so once they're here, there's some neighbor interaction, but there could be also like a...
Yeah, you would see some of this interaction if you look closely at some, I'll show you some. Okay, so this is how we're gonna quantify it experimentally. So this is a tubulin marker in Drosophila embryo in roughly stage 13 at the moment. So you see the asters here, and they're basically surrounding the genetic material. So now you see the spindles forming, and now they separate the genetic material. Run one more time, I guess. So this is Jupiter GFP, so this is some microtubule binding protein that nicely highlights microtubules. So you see these asters here. And then if you look closely at some of them, you see actually that they want to go a certain way, and then at the very last stage, they decided to be scattered by some other asters. Okay, so. Let me see if I find my favorite candidate here. It's a little hard, and so we're just in a process of, I think it's like this one. I mean, you can all see that they're wiggling around, and what we do now is, with image segmentation, we try to find the points, the centers of these asters, and then sort of relate, and we hope we can learn a lot about the interactions as the tissue gets denser.
They're not always on opposite sides of the membrane.
Initially, they're not. No.
I mean, but there was one instance down there someplace where they're only maybe 120 degrees apart.
Yeah, yeah. So that
one, they actually pull it like parallel to their own separation.
Yeah, yeah.
Which means it actually gets pulled.
Yeah. So that would be an indication. So one thing we want to look at is basic deviation for 180 degrees, which would give us a measure for the strengths of the interaction between neighbors, and that as a function as the whole system gets denser.
Is it clear that that deviation from 180 must be due to neighbor interactions?
No. But if it changes over with the distance between nuclei, you can make
yes, it. Yeah, if there's a correlation, then that's a good indication, right?
Yeah, I think the beauty comes from that you have this built-in change of one important parameter. Okay, so I'll just show you a little bit where we're going to take this, and to also show. So we want to. This was all 2D, and we want to do it in 3D. So, and here's the problem. So this is Drosophila, 180 micrometer. So in order to do it in 3D, you sort of have to scan maybe 200 slices, so 1 micrometer space. And division is very fast, so you don't see the waves if you don't come back every 10 seconds. So then you have to basically do 200 planes in 10 seconds. Then we want to take it for 12 hours. And an image is 8 megabytes, okay? So this gives you 7 terabytes of data.
I thought you were going to calculate the total energy deposited in the Drosophila.
So that's also a good point. So with the normal conformal, you can't do it because you will just boil your sample. So at ENGO, there was in the group of Anstelzer, they developed this light sheet microscope, which is basically just illuminating. Conformal, you would illuminate from here and look at it from the same through the same objective. So in this light sheet, you illuminate from here and you look at it from here, and that's the big advantage of that is that you're only illuminating what you're actually looking at. So if you look at the plane here will get as many photons as the plane here. So you bleach, while you go through here, you bleach a lot, right? And if you do it in a confocal, you would basically bleach at least 200 times more than with a flat sheet microscope. And so this is our sort of own implementation of this microscope. So here's the chamber, that's where Drosophila sits. There are two objectives, one from here and one from the back. You can move the sample up, down, left, right, and rotate it if you want. Then there's a EMCCD camera sitting there. The light sheet is generated here, and everything is controlled by this electronics and the computer. And it can sort of take image at 20 to 30 frames a second. And this is sort of what you get afterwards. So this is basically taken from one side, a stack of halfway through the embryo, and then making a 3D image out of it. And this is just the you see the nuclei. And so one problem you still have, if you're very deep inside, you have a lot of scattering, right? So it's still a little too great. But
it's not really confocal. No, so it doesn't prevent any scattering. It doesn't make up for the scattering inside the embryo.
Yes.
It just reduces bleaching.
Yeah. Well, it gives you optical sectioning. Right, because of the light sheet thickness.
But if this sample scatters light,
sure,
the light sheet will be scattered, and it won't be a light sheet anymore.
Okay. Well, it is scattered, but it's
no,
not.
But you don't have light from other focus plane.
Hmm. Well, in the scattering, you will.
Well, in the extreme scattering case, then okay.
The usual problem with, say, epifluorescence is that you have a lot of light from out of focus plane because you shine the light through your objective, and this light can come from out of focus plane. That's why you do the
confocal. The problem is that the photons are not ballistic anymore in the scattering medium.
Yeah,
so you cannot make up for the non-ballistic
path. And what I can tell you is, it is scattered, but it's not as severe as you would feel. And we can get basically almost once through the embryo. But then we look at it from two sides, and then it's fine.
Yes, you can repeat it.
Okay, and basically the concept was developed by Anstelzer. Very happy. So you use it, and this is sort of the microtubule movie on a larger scale, and you see how this, when they basically pull apart, how they basically deform each other, right? So there, you can really see spindles invading other spindles and squeezing spindles, so there's a lot of force generated in this. And we hope we can, by segmenting this, we can learn a lot about the interaction, the order in this. Okay, I'm terribly slow. Until when do we have?
Quarter after 11:15.
Okay. So I'm just going to skip the whole part which is published, I guess. Either talk to me, to Boris, or to Hervé, who's also sitting here in the office, who's also involved in this. The only thing I need is basically this this model. So whenever we model mechanics of tissues, we usually think of it as a grid. And each cell is this little briquette, and it has a certain number of neighbors. And the shape is defined by its vertices. And then we write down some elastic energy for. So a perimeter term wants to make a cell as round as possible. If we just fix the area or the volume. And then there's, here in this case, we have a volume term, but you can also think of it as a 2D area term. And then there might be also some neighbor coupling. So this was basically that thickness coupling, which gives us some confusion. Okay, I guess that's all I need for this. And then, so the other stuff as published, I'm just skipping. Skip this. So now the more interesting thing. So now we have, so we move very quickly into the larvae. And this is how the wing looks in the larvae. It's this this sack of cells. It's an epithelial layer, it's super stratified, very densely packed, very tiny cells, 3 micrometers in diameter. And then in the pupae, basically the wing develops, right? So the metamorphosis is happening there. And this gives you a little idea of what's happened. So this is now the leg. And we took an image of the leg. So the problem there is it starts as a flat pizza, and then the leg gets a single leg Dyson pulse, and then it basically, out of the pizza, there's a tube forming. So this is the first step in this metamorphosis. So you see, this is, you were looking right on top of the pizza, and now the leg comes out. So you see the different segments of the leg. I just hold it right here, somewhere here. So this is the leg. So here are different segments. And the staining is a armadillo chief piece. So it's Peter Cadden outlining the top of the cells, of the epithelial cells. And you see how it basically pokes out here. And the size is about, I think from here to here is half a millimeter. Okay, so that is what's first happening. And then this whole balloon inflates. And there's another deflating event, but then inflates again. There's some more divisions happening we don't care about. And then in the end, the tissue is nicely hexagonally ordered. Before it's very random, show you an image. And then in the end, it's nicely ordered. One order, one parameter you can look at is, are the hairs on the wing. And they all point to the distal direction. And so people were wondering where this order comes from. And then they look more closely, and they found that in addition to the normal basal apical polarity that epithelial tissue have in humans or in mammals, then they also have a planar polarity, so in-plane polarity. And it's quite common, so it's in the fly body, fly eye, and in fish and humans. And there's a lot of genetics known already for this. So this is sort of lots of years of genetics, so planar polarity is the word for this. And so there are genes known which are localized on one side of the cell, on the proximal side, on the distal side. And the key players are this Van Gogh and Frizzled. I think these are the first. And here's the image showing the hair, the actin bundles in the hair pointing in the direction. Okay, so here's the problem. So in the early pupae or in the larvae, third instar, the tissue will look like this. So very disordered. So cells have quite a variable number of neighbors. And then 40 hours after puparin formation, it will look like this, right? So here you see it's basically hexagonal order. It's an hexagonal lattice. And so we asked the question when I was still here, how can that happen, this transition? And one constraint comes right away from Euler. It says that the number of faces plus vertices minus edges in 2D flat has to be 2. And then the other constraint is that we mostly see, mostly means 90, more than 95%, cells which vertices that have 3 legs. And there's another constraint here. And the 2 comes from just double counting the direction of the bond. So if you put this together, you'll find that the average number of neighbors has to be 6 plus some correction on the surface. And in Drosophila, we're talking about 50,000 cells or order of 10,000 cells, so this correction term is not important. So this is the statistics. If you look at the distribution of the number of neighbors for cells, so on average it's 6, but it's quite, you have 5, 7, 8, 4s. That's what you have. And then after the ordering, it's 90% sixes. And then there are a few 5s and 7s. So and what's interesting is, so if you look closely, this is, for example, the 7 here. And right next to it, there's a 5 here. So this is 7, 5 here. And there's another one, here's a 7 here, and the 5 is probably there. So 5, 7 here. So Euler just means there has to be, if there's only 5, 6, and 7, there has to be as many 5s and 7s, right? But it doesn't mean they should be together. And we were asking the question, why do we see this? And how to, is it order, what could be an underlying process of ordering this tissue? Okay, so this ordering process involves many scales. It basically involves some remodeling of junctions, you get here, and whatnot on an intracellular scale. Then I talked about this planar circularity within the cell, and then there's all lattice and the macroscopic scale. So this involves many scales. And just to basically get a very basic idea what ordering mechanism could underlie this phenomenon, we just basically came up with a rule game for ordering. So the rules of the games are you're only allowed to do a T1 process. Right? So that's how you can change the topology of the tissue. If you a T1 process, there's 2 cells pushing in from either side, and then the bond flips over to the other direction. Right? So you have A, B, C, D, goes into So this will get -1 cell, -1 cell, +1, +1. If you go from here to here. So you change the number of neighbors. Euler is still satisfied. But you can change the.
Shouldn't the letters be
different?
The same.
Okay, so the other way to change the topology would be to divide the cell. If you just divide the cell, put a cleavage plane in there, it will look like this. Or you can let the cell apoptose. So it's known that during this process, there's very little division, and you can block apoptosis and it still works. Okay, so we're left with T1 process. So now what we want is basically just figure out what could be a possible strategy. And we basically divided them into 3 different kinds of strategy. One is just topology-based. So if you do a T1 process, so first of all, there's no God, right? No one saying you should do something here in order, because then something here will get better, right? So it's all local decision. So local means T1 process, only 4 cells are involved. And so now you can ask, I have this configuration. If I do this T1 process, do I get closer to the hexagon or not, right? And then I can do it with some probability. So that's a better strategy. The other strategy, and I guess you already know what I favor, is you sort of think at this bond tier, this T1 process, as overcoming some energy barrier, right? So pushing in, and then there's some energy barrier, and then it can relax to a different state. And it might be lower, might be higher. And you could think of having some sort of temperature or some fluctuations in there that can drive you over this barrier.
So if you're including mechanical interactions, then I could imagine long-range stress chains allowing cells to know.
They are.
Okay. So then it's not strictly local, and there could be.
There's a god.
There is a god. In some sense, right?
But it works through a field.
So the third part is this, it could also be planar separability. So there's a big debate if planar separability comes first or ordering comes first. And it's complicated to disentangle these.
Okay, and probably just
why would planar separability mediate the rearrangements?
Well, you could. Well, you see, this planar separability basically wants to have a certain configuration of distribution of proteins on the cell, right? So, Van Gogh, proximal, Frizzle, distally, nothing in between. So, and that sort of has some energy apparently to it. So, it wants to separate them according to this. So, if you now have some other configuration, if you could think that it's less stable than this configuration where this planar separability is. Because there's Frizzle and Van Gogh do transmembrane binding, so you can make a case for this.
Is another one says the direction of the other ones becomes other?
In the fly, yeah, so there's some gradients on some cation, and people think that would be it. But you should talk to Boris more, he's more the planar separability expert. And okay, so let's start with the disordered lattice and just do the topology algorithm. So we're just looking if we do the T1 process, if it gets closer to hexagonal, then we do it with some probability, not do it.
Lars, do you take into account the amplitude of the peak in the middle, or you just base your probability of doing a T1 on?
I just put on this energy here.
Okay. So what the difference between before and after?
I go to my tissue and then just calculate what the energy barrier is, and then do it with some probability energy barrier by divided by some temperature, whatever temperature means in this problem.
So that topology thing, you're essentially doing an edge-floating algorithm to create an optimal monodiagram. Isn't it equivalent to a edge-flipping algorithm for creating a delay triangulation?
I have no idea. Effectively it just looks at the number of neighbors and then calculates some probability in order to flip it.
It's not really geometric, it's combinatorial.
The boundary conditions is that you're just looking at a very small tissue in a huge tissue, and then it's free boundary conditions.
You don't have small periodic.
No, there's no period. It's just, this is probably just 1/10 of the whole thing.
But then why don't you boundary conditions on the whole thing? I'm just curious.
They're just free. There's nothing. Okay, same initial condition, different algorithm.
And the physical. Sorry, what's
the difference? So one is this topology driven algorithm, so we just look at the number of neighbors. However, this is biologically done, I have no idea. And we flip it when, if we do the T1 process, we get closer to the hexagonal as we do it.
So that's basically a topological energy.
Yeah, so this just.
So get some
topological energy.
Spare.
And here we just calculate the mechanical energy, elastic energy, deforming. And both algorithms basically get to a state where also Posophila gets in ordering, right?
But you get these locations, right?
Yeah, and this.
Is that seen in actual?
So the first time I did the simulation, I thought, okay, this is stupid, right? And then I went to Susan Eaton, who is the experimental expert on this, and she said, yeah, this is exactly what they see in the software. Okay.
Is there any coupling between us and this artificial temperature that you put in your model? You could imagine there could be, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we just keep it simple.
Well, but that might, but if you had a feedback like that, that might actually change the patterning that you would see. Mm-hmm. Because you might think that in regions where there's higher stress, you actually have lower energy barriers, for example. So if that could introduce a feedback in the model, that would change your
results. Yeah, I mean, the whole wing is curved, and there are beams, and there's lots of other stuff which are just pushing on the carpet. So one difference you see is that here you get a lot of single defects, right? So this topology algorithm basically does pretty poorly in keeping the, basically isolates defects. And the problem with that is that, and this defect basically imposes its local symmetry onto the surrounding tissue, right? So this is 7-fold defect here. So red is 7, blue is 5. And then, so now if you think about this planar circularity at some point, wants to pattern this wing, right? So it will pattern it from here, and then it doesn't know if it goes this way or this way, right? So having this single defect is actually not a good idea.
Well, unless you have a kind of external gradient that sort of guides the...
Yes.
Which
yeah.
They
yeah, so there is one, but I think there's also...
What happens to the planar cell polarity if they remove the external gradient?
I don't know. I think, yeah, well, that was done, then it basically looks like you should do the course because he knows the guy. I think there, yeah, so there's some, it basically just moves also in some direction. So, and here you see that they always basically keep these pairs together and they even align them.
How important is the deflation inflation, like this, the basically the changes in the mechanical shape of this thing to getting this end result? In other words, right, you said that sort of during this ordering process, mm-hmm. there's also a simultaneous sort of global...
No, that's happening before that.
Okay, and so there's no interplay between any mechanical stresses in the ordering? They happen on completely different...
Well, there's also some... Well, I think what we're after here is some local mechanism that keeps these 5 and 7 together, right? So this is sort of what I would like to understand, right? Because that I observed in terms of their wing. And on larger scales, there are also fluxes, and there's some beautiful new data from Susan Eaton, I think, shows that there's some, what's the largest rearrangement. But so this is sort of just a local understanding how locally you can bind these together.
So is the end result on the right compatible with the experiments, or
do you have? OK, so this is the number of 6s, 5s, and 7s as a function of time. And time is in T1 processes. And for topology and mechanics, and they're both look like the experiment. So here's an experiment done by Susan Eaton. So this they basically measured in 4 or 5 different time points the number of 6, 5, 7. You see 4 and 8 basically are very fast, and that's also what this both algorithm do. And then the other one sort of decays slower, and well, you would be happy with either model, right?
But you could ask where the defects are and where the event sequence.
Yeah, together. So the whole project was basically, the idea of this was to start with a simulation and get an idea of what one should look at in the software. So one point to look at is, so you go to a defect, let's say to the 5, and you ask how many of the 5s you have in the defect have a neighboring 7s pair, right? So that's, and then this topology algorithm does really poorly, just separate them, and this energy just keeps them together. So this is sort of the quantities you have to look at. There are some, in order to look at order parameters, just keep this. Just 1 minute. Okay, I cannot skip all this because it's just great. Bottom line is, so you can also use planar circularity to order it, and basically does as good as we can.
Planar circularity being?
So you put this, on your lattice, you put dynamics of this gene's planar circularity proteins. And then you basically ask, you minimize the degree T1 process according to basically getting this tenancy parties genes closer to the preferred configuration.
Are you keeping a uniform density of proteins on the bonds, or?
Yeah, so the model is here. It's just a spin model on the, so you can just think of it as spin having fizzled, disheveled, and then there's some sort of just a spin model.
Well, what sets the, what do you think sets the effective temperature in the actual tissue?
Well, it's not that there's a lot of remodeling on.
That's actually a testable thing, right? So if you can actually change the level of incoherence or...
Yeah. I mean, the genetic stuff right now. So just to finish this, so why is it good for Drosophila to have 5s and 7s together? And so this sort of illustrates. So I just generated this little butterfly of this little defect here. And so now if you want to move this defect in the tissue, all you have to do is just a T1 process here or here. So then it moves up or down on this fine line. So if you play it backwards, you basically this one goes up, this one goes down, and the nine layer will be away, right? So they're sort of freely diffusing duplets in there. So if you ask, so suppose you have a single defect and you want to annihilate it with some cell which is somewhere else, what you have to do is, if you move it just one cell, you always generate this double defect, which then you have to annihilate against another double defect in opposite. So anytime you move this, you send out a photon which you have to find a matching anti-photon. And so it's way more involved in this. So it's actually beneficial for the Drosophila to keep them together, right? However, if it does it by PCP, polarity, or mechanics, I don't know, but topology is not
Is there a good propensity for, say, larger cells to perform more T1 cells, to T1 transitions?
So this model would predict, this mechanics model would predict the barrier is, height of the barrier is basically direct proportional to the length of the bond. Because it's all parabolic potential,
but
right?
Not so, to the area of the cell.
No, it's just a bond length. To a good approximation.
Okay. You could think of the situation.
So, in this very simple model, it's almost, I mean, it's very well, it's just the length of the bond. Okay, so that's the bottom line. So this is sort of acknowledging the people involved in this, first of all, the lab I set up in Amble, and then some internal Amble collaboration. So this was also done with together with Stefano De Renzis, and Damian Boda is also a great help for Drosophila. So he's working on dorsal filter, and we're working together with him. We also work a little bit with zebrafish, with Darren Gilmore, and let's see. So obviously, we work a lot together and discuss a lot together with Boris and also with Alberto about tissue mechanical properties in very clean system. And Aurelius Hedemann was also, we're also working a lot together. And the part I didn't show you about the wing size determination, either just come talk to me, Boris, or maybe. Thank you for your attention. One more thing. I always ask if I speak in front of a physics audience because we're trying to attract more physicists to Ample. So to put up this slide, so this is Heidelberg, we're somewhere. So they put the nuclear physics and biology up on the mountain because they were afraid. So our graphics design student made this, and I'm not sure if you're supposed to be the next toy model, but anyhow, so if you know postdoc, there are interesting postdoc programs, and the PhD program is, I think, very good. So if you know someone interested in being embedded in a biological environment, but there are a lot of physicists also, so it won't be alone. All right, thank you.
The analysis at the end relied on the fact that your vertex model had a hexagonal ground state. And there are regions of parameter space, basically, that where that model doesn't have one. Mm-hmm. And so the question is there, are there mutants or things that sort of you, or could you imagine thinking about a situation where you could move the system into that parameter regime, and then that would sort of tell you basically that your model, that there's this energy, mechanical energy functional, could be screwed up in this particular way, and then you don't get this hexagonal ground state anymore. You don't approach it.
Well, I think there's this work done by Yuka where he basically showed that, well, you have this transition between this either hexagonal state or the other one. And I think what the important parameter there is sort of, I guess, the strength of the surface tension term is, so in that model, what they basically do is, I think they force the perimeter to be larger than the what you expect from square root of area, right?
Yeah.
From circle. Right. As soon as you do this, then the system wants to basically don't, the cells don't want to be round anymore, but some other shape, and then the hexagon is not a ground. So how to do that experimentally, I don't know.
So as I recall from Suzanne's video, there are sort of flows. Is that happening at an earlier or a later stage than this? Or
I think that's sort of simultaneously to this, right? That's sort of large scale flow.
Right. So the question is, if a flow or a wave or something propagates through one of these situations where you had those domain walls,
mm-hmm.
would the domain walls get moved along?
So that's an interesting question. If that is actually the sliding zone.
So that could be the way.
So we're also trying to do some imaging on this. So I think, yeah, so that is, so there's a large scale aspect to this, and there's a lot of flow, as you said. And this small, the local aspect is basically what we were interested in how these fives and sevens to keep them together. And it seems to keep them together on top of it that there's flow, right?
Yeah.
So you think maybe flow is just separating them. But there's still, you still find a significant amount of fives and sevens in the wing, right?
But really the bottom line is so trying to map it back to observables. So one day you'll have a beautiful segmentable movie, mm-hmm. of this whole process, and so you'll be able to start with this disordered array and track things all the way to an ordered array, mm-hmm. and along the way identify how many T1 processes you have,
mm-hmm.
and see how, for example, the growth of hexadic order depends on time measured in these T1 units.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the biggest problem with having a flow on top of that is that the flow will also involve T1 processes and will sort of mess up that time axis. Mm-hmm. So we sort of have to figure out how to how to distinguish the flow as a.
So if we manage to get this movie sometime to in a segmentable fashion, then there's so many things one can look at, right? It's basically this model would predict that the T1 process probability depends, the mechanics model, on the length of the bond, right? So these are sort of ways you can unfold the T1 process. You can ask, is that what you see, or you can also ask a T1 process if you see some local topological order in it, right? So I think once you have all this, you're as long as you play it locally, it's all good, right? So the flow, then.
But I think even with the flow, you should be able to because again, you know who's moving where, and on average, you should be able to figure out how many T1 processes you need just to rearrange the mass around, right? So to change the shape of the tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And so probably, which leaves sort of important simple problem of distinguishing between the two different mechanisms of localizing destinations, right? So distinguishing between plane cell polarity and mechanics. So that presumably will take some genetics to disable plane cell polarity and see if one still.
Yeah, so when I did this, I was sort of hoping that
goes order.
Just one out of the three would work, right? That will make everything a little easier. But now, I mean, it's still, I mean, we can't contribute a little bit to this debate what comes first by looking how efficient these processes, plants of the large processes and mechanics are. But in the end, I mean, they're basically, for some of the measures we, or I looked at it, basically the same.
The plane of cell polarity model, is there the same dependence on the T1 transition on length?
No, there's no length anymore.
So that is that also a way to test?
Yeah, that's probably, listen, you know, there's no length in this model, but, there are...
Well, it comes in a weird way, I guess.
Receptor ligand pairs on
the... You will have cells that have more neighbors that have shorter lengths. Yeah. The planets of polarity will do differently on this than cells will do less neighbors. So you can get it in a very weird.
But there might be other ways.
Your punchline is that this hexagonalization can come either from just mechanics, I mean driving T1s, or from a PCP model. But yeah. So now experiments have been done where you disrupt PCP, and so there's still hexagonalization.
So that works.
You can knock down one of the freezer.
Yeah, so that you can do, and then there's less order. And so the problem is that most of these have dual rules also involved in other processes. So you would also think that they're involved in some of it, maybe something. So it's hard to disentangle this. And that's why this debate is
going on. But I guess what you need to do is induce some sort of a large frizzle clone.
Mm-hmm.
Induce very late.
Yeah.
It's just that. Whatever, 18 hours after the equation or something, and then the process just starts,
yeah.
And then see if the order within your large flow is any better or worse than the answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think this model will make a lot of predictions on it, and you can, and mechanics and PCP will make different predictions, but we haven't really played it this way.
Can't they be coupled together?
Yeah, so that's my best guess. So if you ask, right? I would say initially it's done mechanics, and then PCP is locking it in.
So is the PCP responding to the surface of the cells? Is that how you establish the polarity?
Say that again, PCP is responding
to the order of the cells.
Yeah, so that. Yeah, so that is the general question.
It also
what comes first, right?
So it's but not only what comes first, but is it causal?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's some experimental evidence, but usually, mostly you knock something out and then you basically screw up everything.
Yeah.
So, deprogramizing tubulin, right? Mm-hmm. Won't order anymore. Yeah, there are ways to do this.
You can make bigger cells. That will affect mechanics and maybe
make clones with make a new clone.
Yeah.
It all scales, doesn't it?
Well, you would just have it.
Yeah,
it's not homogeneous.
One size
yeah. Yeah. It's not homogeneous. Just as
hard. There's easy genetic ways to do that.
I can cross flies. I can make a mutant fly, but I can't. can keep them alive.
Biologically, is this PCP involved in other things?
Yeah. I mean, some examples should be here. It's in your kidney.
No, I mean.
I mean, for the front of the subject. Body hair, for example.
Yes.
It's in your ears.
Eyes, probably.
It's very important. So lots of epithelial tissues have this.
So where does your T1 start?
It will generate, at some point, it will just generate some background pop-up of defects. And then they usually go away fast because it's energetically more favorable to just.
So, I mean, the picture you show on the right side has been the result of kind of a convergence.
Yeah, so it
I couldn't do any more transformation there.
It is just. Some leading process. Yeah, so I mean, it will go to this, and you will once in a while you will see it will generate a spontaneously a defect, but then that goes away very quickly because this defect usually has such a high energy to it, and it usually disappears fast. But it can generate defects, obviously. So there would be some background, and also Drosophila is not perfectly axonal. So there's still some defects in the tissue there.
The direction of the light comes about related to the direction of flow.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
But if you stretch a collection of cells, you would expect that the light is a direction.
Mm. And we did some movies. We took some movies on this, but we haven't analyzed them yet. And I know Susan is working hard on this with all genetic power.
Can you like this slide here? So here, can you put up the graphs of the distribution? So now, there's this transition where the cell sides become ordered, but do you also measure the distribution of the sizes of the cells? Because the spatial order, the sizes of
I think
the
what was known is which is consistent with this mechanics model, I think, is that cells with less neighbors than 6 are usually smaller than the ones with more. And that's also found in Drosophila. Mm-hmm. So that's a correlation with area as a function of number of neighbors.
Yeah.
So that would go away.
Maybe the process going from order to disorder, or disorder to order, is just the cells are.
So that's what we thought of initially, just in our model. This mechanics model I just showed you. So I just thought, okay, let's crank up this term. Right? Just make them all look equal, but. And then see if it gets ordered. But it's a very glassy.
Where did you apply the 3D active contour on the building?
Not in this talk. But it's so wait here. So that's so we do it on this images here. So this is sort of 3D. And then we can basically follow the nuclei from the first division now to at least optically segmentation. But we'll hope. So that's sort of the long-term project is, see, track them over the first couple of hours and get all the trees out.
Again, you believe they're still only on the surface, or they are?
No, they're also inside. So they're, so they're inside.
But for this analysis, you would do a stage where they're only on surface also?
Well, for this, it would be. For this model, we just need to go around, just rotate it and look at it, and go a few micrometer deep. But I think long term would be very nice to just see after the first division. So my dream is, first division you pattern one cell right, the other one green, and then you see where all the cells go right after 12 hours. Where are they?